This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, Series 4, Episode 40, The James Bond of Coaching. Coming up on this week's Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, we find out why Mark Garraway is the James Bond of coaching. We talk about running between the wickets, tactics in 30-over matches, and what to do if you're a keeper and you turn up on a real Bunsen burner of a pitch. All that and more coming up on the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. It's time for the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. Welcome along again to the show. My name is David Hinchliffe. I am the Ferris Bueller of Pitch Vision. I'm loved by the sportos, the motorheads, the geeks, the wastoids, and the dweebs. They all think I'm a righteous dude. And joining me on the line from his headquarters is the James Bond of cricket coaching, Mark Garraway. Welcome along.
I don't know how to respond to that, to be brutally honest, and I'm sure nor would Daniel Craig.
Well, I know you like your martini shaken, not stirred, and you love a gadget, so.
That is true. Q would have always been my best friend, I think, in the James Bond films. I do love a gadget, as you quite rightly say.
And Berners, unfortunately, he's not here. I had him down as the odd job.
I like it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the bowler hat that does it for him. Anyway, let's talk about cricket. And although there's been some news going on, the thing that I really was interested in this week was a bit of research. And of course, friend of the Pitch Vision Academy cricket show, Lawrence Houghton, who has been on this very show a number of times, has written an interesting article about running between the wickets, the science of it. And Garraz, you've had a look at that. And where do you see the research and experience of running between the wickets?
Well, it's brilliant, actually. I've really enjoyed reading through it. And the research is there to back up the main points which are in the document. And the thing that I'm a big fan of is practicing what we are going to end up doing matches in our practices. So I've always been somebody who's incorporated running between the wickets into our practices that we have. Much to the disappointment of some that obviously you get quite tired quite quickly, but that is the game. And now, through Lawrence's work, we can actually become a little bit more targeted in terms of the techniques and the approaches that we can use to get people to be more efficient running between the wickets. And ultimately, the next stage for me on top of Lawrence's work is then the decision-making processes, because obviously that's a very physical aspect to it that he's done his research into. But the next phase would be to add on top of that some decision-making drills and processes that can make his work even more impactful. So I love it, and I've actually stuck it out to all of our first team and all of our coaches for discussion this week as a result of the work that Lawrence has done. So I'm intrigued to see what comes back from those guys.
Yeah, the mechanics of running and where you hold your hat, how you hold the bat, and those kind of things are all really important aspects. But like you said, Gareth, the really important thing for me is that initial judgment of whether there is going to be a run there or not is kind of the key to it all. It doesn't matter how fast you run; if it's a bad run, you're still not going to make it. I'd be interested because it's a bit of a commentator's cliche, isn't it, to say that it's very rare that if both players set off for a run and there's no hesitation, that more often than not that they make it, and it's hesitation which causes the most runouts. I'd be interested to see the numbers on that, whether that's the case. Do you know? I mean, it feels like that's right. It's more to do with when things go wrong than when you both absolutely set off at top whack and your judgment is going to be more on the ball, so therefore you're going to make it. Do you know the numbers behind that, Garraz?
I've got no idea whether that's been done, but my question would be now, surely that should be done. But equally, before Lawrence put together his research on techniques and approaches to running between the wickets and trying to increase speed, particularly around a running three, which I thought he came up with some really interesting ideas about turning your quickest side always. If there's a run that you're definitely looking to convert into three rather than, going against, I suppose, our notion of turning blind. So In terms of decision making, I'm not aware of any, but again, it would be something I'd like to put on top of this body of research that he's done in order to sort of complete the circle, I suppose. My feel on what you just said about decision making and hesitation is that that makes sense. But as fielders get quicker, as we practice hitting the stumps more, and there's a definite difference between the amount that we practice hitting the stumps and then the amount we practice stealing runs. I'd be really interested to do more research on that decision making process, because we spend hours, don't we, hitting stumps, but actually the other side of a coin is somebody trying to steal runs, and we talk about it a lot, but we don't necessarily practice it a lot.
I did a fun game with some of the younger kids this year, which was just a variation on the very simple, you have the run out game, don't you, where you have two teams and one team have to run a two and the other team have to do some kind of piece of fielding to get the ball in as quickly as they can to stop to run the person out as quickly as they can. And if you set that up correctly, you know, you get the distance of the fielder right and everything, then that can be quite a lot of fun for all ages. But you know, the youngsters really love it because there's a lot of tearing it about. I added a variation where you say, well, you can judge whether you want to run the second or not. That worked pretty well. They got it wrong more often than they got it right, which was interesting. But they were also very cautious, and there were a lot of singles run when twos could have been made. But I think that puts a little bit of a decision-making process into it, as well as the getting the technique down. So that was something fun we did this summer that seemed to work quite well.
Yeah, it's good. We've got our indoor cricket league starts today. Ooh. So we've created an indoor cricket league amongst our players at the school, and that starts today. And of course, indoor cricket is a lot of it is about running. And I'm intrigued about some of the decisions that are going to be made. And I'm also intrigued at how people's decision making processes, which is one of the reasons why I've brought this in, improve over the course of the 10-week season that we're going to be having. So I'm expecting a few calamitous type runouts this afternoon, and a few arguments in the middle of the pitch between batters. I'm looking forward to all of that happening. But the key thing for me is what are the learnings from it, and how much more effective and more efficient they find run making in the indoor game, which hopefully then will translate into those knocking the balls into gaps and taking pace off the ball in the outdoor game when we come to playing next April.
Okay, let's head into the yes-no round. Three questions that every week are asked, and Gareth and I can only answer yes or no to them, no matter how much more we want to say. So, Gareth, I'll do the honours with the questions this week. If you could answer first, and then I'll chime in with what I think. First question, elite head coaches are more mentors than coaches.
Yes.
Yes. Second question, short batsmen have an uphill battle to become excellent.
No.
No. Third question, you don't have to be fast if you're crafty.
No.
Yes. It's interview time on the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. We always like to get a view on cricket from different angles, and it's no different this week. I'm joined by Sean Hooper of the Cornish Cricket Company. Welcome to the show, Sean.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you very much. Now, what is it that you get up to there in Cornwall?
Well, the Cornish Cricket Company is a little bit like a Ron Seal advert. It does what it says on the tin, so we're involved in everything cricket. We started off as a coaching company, and gradually we've grown that, and we've now developed into a coaching company with a shop, and we're involved in most things going on in cricket in Cornwall.
Fantastic. And when you think of hotbeds of cricket, you don't necessarily think immediately of Cornwall. So what is the cricket scene like there?
The cricket scene is relatively strong. I think if you go back over 20 years, Cornwall schools had a fantastic system, and we were producing cricketers. And there's a passion for the game down here. But last year, Cornwall were minor counties champions. So, and there were 10 members of the side on the field on the final day that had gone through the Cornwall school system. So there's sort of a passion for it. But we're not producing test cricketers at the moment. We've got a few in the first class game. A couple of lads up at Gloucestershire that are playing Played first team cricket this year in Tom Shrewsbury, the England under 19 spinner, and Liam Norwell. And we've got others on the academies. We've got three or four lads on the Notts Academy. So we've got, we're producing cricketers, but yeah, it's not renowned. It's more renowned for our pasties and our holidays, really, than our cricket.
Well, you certainly should think that the weather there would be a little bit more conducive to cricket than in other parts of the country. I'm thinking Lancashire, perhaps.
Absolutely. Well, the thing is that we're wet like them. Because we're on the west coast, we still pick up plenty of the wet, but we're a lot warmer, I think. So yeah, it's very nice, but it's a very nice place to live. So it's quite difficult sometimes to get people to really get driven to push themselves to play cricket.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so do you have issues with participation in the area?
I went to an ECB Discover meeting in the week, and the ECB reckon we've got 8,600 people playing. Now, that seemed like rather a lot to me, but we get, like most places, we get a lot of interest, and the Chance to Shine program has been fantastic to get kids playing. But it's that transition from school to club, and then keeping them when they're sort of between 14 and 20 is a real challenge, as, with lots of other things happening in their lives. But so we get them started, okay, but it's you know, that making sure we can hold on to them is a big challenge.
Yeah, and I think that's a challenge around the world as well. I mean, you even see it. You even see it in. I mean, you don't just see it in the hotbeds of cricket in the UK. You see it in India, where there's the pressure for talented players to find a career and go to university and give up on their ambitions of, you know, playing in the blue of India. So it happens all over the world, even in places where you wouldn't necessarily think. What would you say would be some advice to someone who is facing that challenge? How can you influence people and help them and help get more people stay in the game?
That's a really good question. I think one of the things that, you know, the reason we all start playing cricket is we want to have fun. I think we've got to try and ensure that we have fun, but it's making sure that the people remain challenged and included and welcome at the same time. So if you've got people that wanted to play professional cricket, they're perhaps driven by different factors than people that just love playing the game and want to be involved every week. So really, it's trying to keep it as much fun for people as possible, because, you know, we're losing volunteers hand over fist everywhere. And I think in order to get people coming through, we need to try and make it a great environment so that they keep wanting to turn up. And certainly I've noticed it's with the evolution of the women's game in this country, cricket clubs are becoming a lot more friendly and open to sort of females, other than just sticking them in the tea room. They're now very much more integrated into more the whole clubs, which I think has got to be up.
So if there's people listening and they want to find out a little bit more about what you do there and type of equipment that you sell and the coaching that you do, what would they need to do to find out?
Well, we've got a fairly comprehensive website, which we're constantly updating. They can follow us on Twitter or on Facebook, and then we give regular updates. But we've got a strong staff, three full-time coaches. Myself as a level four, Chris Hunkin a level three, about to complete his level four, and Gary Byrne about to become a level three. We also work in the shop and sort of give the advice on the stuff that we sell. We sell all the major brands, but we've also got a situation where my dad is making cricket bats for us in the garage of his home, which is great fun. But we work really close with clubs and with people, and we're open to trying to do things to make things better in cricket in Cornwall, really, but also beyond. But we've got a fairly good website if people wanted to have a look. It's www.thecornishcricketcompany.co.uk.
Fantastic. Thanks for that. And I do encourage people to go and have a look at that, no matter where you are in the world, because there's some nice information on there for anyone who's a bit of a cricket badger like myself. So thanks a lot for your time, Sean.
Pleasure, David. Thank you.
Well, let's delve into the mailbag, and as Berners is not here this week to do his normal duties of picking the questions, I've got a couple of questions here which I've picked out for us to have a little look at. A couple of detailed ones as well, Gareth, so hopefully we can get stuck in and see what you think. So the first question is from Jonty. I don't think it's that one. And he says, first of all, he says he likes the Pitch Vision guide, so thanks very much for that. That's a bit of back slapping for us there. But he says his college game is about a week from now, and he's a bit worried about having a bowling plan to defend a target. And he gives us an example of the type of situation that he's in. And then, Gareth, maybe you can tell us what you think if you were in a similar situation to this. The target roughly would be 130 to 150 in 30 overs. Slow pitch with low bounce. He's got a lot of bowlers available to him. 6 medium pacers and 2 off-spinners with a 6-over limit per bowler. He says the 2 medium pacers are good at the death. So, what kind of approach to tactics should Jonty have, Gareth?
Well, I was taught during my professional career, of which I was captain for a lot of it, and I was taught through my experience and also some really good exponents and captaincy, somebody like Mark Nicholas, who now commentates, the late, great Malcolm Marshall, that you should always start every session with the best 2 bowlers for those conditions at that given time. So out of your medium paces, or it might be an off-spinner, because we're seeing a bit more of that, your best 2 bowlers for those given that given set of circumstances and that given condition that you're facing at that time, which is a slow pitch with low bounce, they're the 2 that should get involved first. They should open the bowling because they set the tone. So, you know more about your bowlers than me. I can't tell you which ones would be better, but that is a basic. And that doesn't matter in this context, which is a 30-over game, or a 50-over game, or coming out in a longer format a game and bowling after lunch. Always the best 2 bowlers need to start off the session, because you only get 1 opportunity to set the tone, and that is it. So that would be my first thing. The other thing is then you've got to decide how you're going to use your 2 off-spinners, because obviously they are in the minority of your bowling attack. So do you want to split their spells? Do you want to use them when there's left-handers in? Do you want to get them through in tandem so you can get 12 overs out the way very, very quickly before the opposition have worked out that they're behind the 8-ball? So whichever way you operate as a team, use those spinners best. Some of them might do better in 2 spells, but my experience so far in coaching has been that generally if you've got a spinner going, the best thing is to leave him bowling. And there was a great example recently of a young man who played in the YB40 final at Lord's for Glamorgan, who bowled 6 overs fantastically and then was taken off. And it was his first game, I think. He was making his debut in the final. And he was taken off, and then he was brought back to bowl his 7th over a bit later in the game, and he got nailed in that and ended up not bowling his 8th over. And really, on that pitch, which was a slow but turning pitch, he should have bowled his 8 overs all the way through. So think about how you want to use your off-spinners, all right? If it is a slow, low pitch, you might have the opportunity to get 10 or 12 overs of off-spin out in tandem, so working together, which effectively is between 33% and 40% of the overs that you're going to bowl. So if you can use those guys and you can get them out of the way and you can do a Chris Gayle and rush through your overs, all of a sudden, 40% of the innings is gone and the opposition then need to do something. So those would be the things that I would think about. Then 2 of your medium pacers are good at the death. You've got those. Again, it's really difficult to bowl 1 over of medium pace at the death and just come on and nail your skills. So you might want to give them 2 overs. So there's your last 4 overs. You've got 10 to 12 overs out the way from your 2 off-spinners on a slow and low wicket. They can bowl in tandem. And all of a sudden, you've got the semblance of a bowling plan there. So that's what I would do. Best 2 bowlers to start off with. Get your 2 off-spinners bowling in tandem if you can, if the circumstances allow. Get 3 your overs quickly, and then you've got your 4 overs at the end from 2 of your medium pacers who are very good at bowling Yorkers and slow balls and whatever that meets the demands that you have at the end of a game. You've only got to make up another 8 overs, and you've got your total plan. So that would be my advice.
Well, that's cracking, Gareth. I'm just talking and making up those 8 overs. If you've got guys who are not so good and you need to sneak them in, is there a case for if the team are falling behind the rate a little bit and you see an opportunity to get somebody on and sneak in a couple of those make-up overs, would that be a good opportunity to do that if you've got somebody bowling well?
Yeah, absolutely. But the challenge with it a little bit is when do you choose to do that? And sometimes you want your best bowlers to bowl. Say you've got 2 batters in on naught or 1 or 2 or whatever. Then you probably want to go with your better bowlers because you've got an opportunity to knock those 2 guys over and expose at least 1 of the ends to batters that are new to the wicket again. So you might choose that actually I'm going to attack from one end and I'm going to use the two new batters as people that are probably going to play themselves in on a slow low wicket to get, you know, my fifth bowler or my sixth bowler through a couple of overs to do that. It's entirely how you want to play it. You know, if you want to win the game in the 26 over by bowling them out, you probably wouldn't do that. But if you were looking to build up the pressure so they need 30 off the last two, which is unlikely on that wicket, then you might put in your fifth or sixth bowler, or maybe your seventh bowler in at a time where you've got two batters on naught or naught and one or whatever the case may be. Again, that's all down to your own personal preference, and I've seen both work. So there's no hard and fast rule on that one.
You kind of have to go on what you feel, your hunch at that moment. Okay, good luck, Jonty. Let us know how you get on. Let us know if your brilliant master plan tactics come off and you are the talk of the college for the rest of the season. Our next question is from Lalit. Lalit's a wicketkeeper, so we like him already. And he says, while wicketkeeping for an off-spinner, many a time a vicious turner goes through the gap between the bat and pad of the right-handed batsman. And those are the ones I tend to miscollect or totally miss, especially if there's extra bounce as I lose sight of the ball. Similarly, if the batsman shuffles across to the offside to play a sweep or reverse sweep, he again blocks my view, making it hard to collect in case he misses the ball. How can I solve this problem? Is there anything specific I can do to solve it? And he was telling us that he plays in Karnataka in India. So Garuz, he's playing on an absolute Bunsen. He's finding it a nightmare to keep. What's the answer?
Well, firstly, what an exciting prospect it is and a challenge to overcome. And I think often the way that you set your mind up for this will determine the way that you end up keeping, because the norm would be in wicketkeepers to go, oh my goodness, this is impossible. And as a result, their performance is likely to mirror their mindset. Whereas actually what we try to do with our keepers is to encourage them when the ball starts to do stuff and it brings them into the game. That's an opportunity that you thrive on. I remember keeping, and I mentioned this to a lad that I'm coaching now, who's England under 17 wicketkeeper. I mentioned this to him the other day, which was I played at Old Trafford and the wicket had been played on for, it looked like, 3-4 weeks. And the rough was absolutely massive. And I looked at it and I knew that our spinners were going to be bowling in this championship match probably 70 of 110 overs. And I set my mind up for it. And actually, we didn't get round to 110 overs because our spinners bowled well, our back pad fielders were fantastic, and I managed to do a couple of decent things behind the stumps. But that was only because I'd set my mind up and I saw it as a challenge rather than as an impossible situation. So that's the first thing that I'd say, to get your mind right. The second thing, when the ball is spinning a lot, and you mention it here about it coming between bat and pad, and possibly when people start to reverse sweep on those wickets, which is an option for a batter on a wicket such as that, where straight batted shots often get taken out of the equation, is viewing. So, you know, we can't catch what we can't see is a real basic element of wicketkeeping. So you'll see a lot of wicketkeepers either stand slightly wider to give themselves a view to get beyond the outside edge or the batter's bulk of their body or whatever the case may be. Or you'll see that keepers tend to peer around the outside. And somebody who does that is a guy called James Foster, who keeps wicket for Essex, kept wicket for England. So he'll retain his foot position, but he'll make sure that he can see the ball by peering around the outside of edge of the bat to make sure that he's got a chance of seeing it and therefore catching it. So that would be the first thing that I'd do to you. Make sure your vision's right, because without your vision, you've got no chance whatsoever. The other thing then you do is you load your practices. And the way that you load your practice, and somebody, Paul Nixon and myself, used to have huge amounts of fun doing this, is creating a drill and using every bit of kit that we possibly could, including somebody else's kit bag or a chair or whatever the case may be, which effectively would provide us with a target that we could bowl around or through that would obscure our vision, not so much a vision between the bowler and the keeper, but the vision of between ball bounce and it then coming through to the keeper. It's also good for the ball to hit that obstacle as well, because that's realistic, isn't it? Not every ball is going to come through to us. And I see a lot of wicket-keeping practice where keepers are brilliant at it because they know that every ball is going to come through to them, and they go in there thinking that's fantastic. And then, of course, in a game, some balls get hit, other balls get left, and some balls get nicked. So we need to try and replicate our practice as best as possible. So if a ball spins and hits the middle of this upturned cricket bag and lands on the floor, that's replicating realism, and we need to factor that in. So, for example, a chair. So if you get a wooden chair, obviously you're going to lose the sight of a ball. If the ball goes underneath the chair, then you're going to lose the sight of a ball, and that's replicating the type of issue that you're presenting to us there. In terms of technique, the crucial thing is that even when you lose sight of that ball, that you're able to control your body in terms of the tension that you have in your shoulders in particular. So what often happens when people can't see the ball, they get very tense and very rigid with their body. As a result, when that ball then reappears and comes through to you, your body isn't ready to receive the ball. So the more we load our practice and the more you do it, the more comfortable you'll come, and always rate how your shoulders are feeling. So when you're doing these practices, give feedback to your coach or your thrower on how your shoulders are feeling. Because if you can relax your shoulders, generally, you'll be in a position to be able to react and take the ball. So the first thing is vision. The second thing is loading your practice using obstacles or cones, or if there's an old pitch, then kick the heck out of it and get somebody to chuck it into the rough. I had a fantastic practice with Peter Moores' son the other day at school where we're indoors. We put down a mat, and I got loads of gravel from outside, and I stuck the gravel on top of this mat to replicate the rough. And the ball would hit the gravel, and it would fly off at different directions or go along the ground or fly up in the air. Or if it missed the mat, then it would just bounce normally. We stuck another obstacle in front, so it might hit the obstacle in front, replicating the batter. And that's the sort of thing it can really easily be done. It didn't cost us any money because I nicked a doormat from outside the hall that we were in, and I stuck some stones on it that didn't cost us anything because they came from the pathway. So those sort of things are the types of practice that I would do.
Well, that is one of your most comprehensive answers, Gary, as I've got to say. A couple of little things to add, really. I mean, I can't really do any more than what you've said, but a couple of little things I can add. The key thing for me is seeing it pitch is a really important aspect for me personally as a keeper. If I feel like I can see the ball pitch, I feel like I've got a fairly good chance of getting to it, no matter what it does off the pitch. And you also mentioned about being relaxed. I think that is absolutely crucial as well, because if you feel confident, then you're more relaxed, and then you're more likely to get the ball. So I can't argue with that at all.
One of the best drills, and again, it doesn't cost very much. If you can buy from hardware stores insulation foam that goes around. That goes around pipes to stop them from freezing, and it's really cheap stuff. And if you get somebody to bat in front of the keeper with that and ask them to try and hit the ball with it, so when it hits it, it just makes a slight deflection. Obviously, the ball's too heavy, so that it will move the foam out of the way to get through to the keeper. And obviously, it then acts as an obstacle as well that the keeper has to try and get their eyes around. And you can get people, as you say, waggling their bat in front of your face. And it's just trying to simulate all of the different things that you're gonna get in front of you. But they're great bits of kit, that insulation like tubing. And you can get people to bat with that. And another one is we've seen and we've talked about the Fusion multi-stumps, for example. You can do exactly the same with those. So undo the spike on the bottom or the metal plate and just get somebody to bat in front of the keeper with that. Because if a ball hits that, then often it nicks through and goes through to the keeper and simulates an edge. And also you can play over the top and hit the ground, which is another one which wasn't mentioned in the question, but a lot of keepers find it difficult when a guy goes down the wicket and he hits over the top of the ball.
Oh, yeah.
And it isn't just the fact that they've blocked the view, it's the noise of the bottom of the bat hitting the floor as well that can do them. So again, the more you can simulate the types of challenges that you're going to get in these situations, the more you're going to prepare your body and your mind to be able to deal with it when you do get on a wicket which spins, whether you're being in India, as Lalit's talking about, or like I was back in 1846 or whenever it was up at Old Trafford.
Also, it's very important your reaction when you do something good. If you do get the judgment right and there's an absolute snorter, which you get both gloves on, even if there's no result, even if you've just caught it and it's a dot ball, your reaction is very important there, isn't it, Gareth? So you don't want to be jumping up and down saying and going, look how good I am. You just want to casually toss it to first slip and go, well bowled.
Exactly, and I wish I'd have heard that bit of advice when I was keeping wicket, because I probably did the first thing rather than the second thing.
Okay, so I'm just getting news that we can cross live to a Pitch Vision headquarters, because I understand that the boss is waiting, and he's got an announcement to make, a news announcement regarding some interesting Pitch Vision exciting stuff. So let's head over there now and find out what's happening.
Thanks, David. Well, I'm very proud to announce that we have been chosen by Cricket South Africa to provide all of the technology for the new Centre of Excellence in Pretoria. We'll be providing all four lanes with Pitch Vision technology, providing all the shot tracking, delivery tracking, video bowling machines and video analysis. It's a really great day for us. We've worked very hard for many years to bring our technology to this elite level. And certainly in a very competitive marketplace, we're extremely proud that Cricket South Africa has chosen our technology across all these different platforms. Delighted also that we can make a contribution to South African cricket, and that with Pitch Vision being scalable, we can provide these systems out into the regions and provide a whole data pathway for the players of South Africa. The venue opens in December 2013, and we're really looking forward to working with Corey Van Zyl and the rest of the Cricket South Africa team. Back to you, David, and the team.
Okay, Mark Garraway, there's 60 seconds on the clock, and you can talk about anything you like, but don't pause or hesitate. Just keep going, and we'll see what you're going to come up with in this week's Soapbox. Over to you.
I love a question, and my question this week is, do you coach to be liked or to be respected? And I think it's a really interesting one. It's a question that we ask on the Level 4 program before people come into our Level 4 program. Gordon Lord asks this question on a regular basis to people that are sitting in front of us. And not that there's any right or wrong answer, because there isn't, but the more I coach, the more I realise that it's more important to me, and I'm only talking for myself, so you can disagree with me if you want, is to be respected rather than necessarily always liked. And the reason why I say that is I started off trying to be the guy that everybody liked. But that made me more of a player rather than a coach. And it limited the ability for me to be able to give clean feedback to people, and also to give them a telling off at times. And sometimes you have to do that. And I'm not somebody who's massively into telling off. I'm more into giving life lessons and giving them the option of changing behaviours and shifting behaviours. But I can only do that, really, if I'm in a position of respect rather than like. So get rid of your banter, get rid of your childish stuff that makes you feel like a player again, and in my view, try and build up levels of respect. Then see how your players develop as a result of that. So that's my lesson for today, and that's my question. Like or respect, which is more important to you?
That is about all we've got time for on this week's Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. But before we leave, we've got to decide on one more thing, and that, of course, is the winner of this week's prize, which is the online coaching course, courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy. And Gareth, you're deciding this week, as always, Jonty's question about tactics and Lalit's question about wicketkeeping. Which one did you prefer?
Well, we've asked for more detail in our questions, haven't we? And over the weeks, we get loads of questions, and sometimes it doesn't lead us to be particularly specific in what we're doing. So I'm actually going to break what the role is that I've got here, and I'm going to say both Jonty and Lalit are going to receive a free course this week. And the reason being is that their questions are so specific, and really, they set the benchmark and the standard for others to follow. So it would be very difficult for me to choose between the two, and actually I'd like to reward both. But equally, If we get a week where the questions aren't good enough, I do have the right to say, well, actually, neither question deserves it, so keep trying.
Oh, fantastic. Okay, well, this is a break from the normal, and I like that. That's good. I'm going to have to check the budget to make sure we've got enough to be able to do both of those, but I'll crunch the numbers, and we'll get jaunty, and like, maybe I'll have a couple of less coffees next week to make up for it.
Sorry about that, buddy.
So, Gareth, if somebody was thinking to themselves, well, hang on a minute, I've got double the chance now of winning a prize, how would they send in their question to the show and have it read out and have it answered?
Well, they won't have, because it's a one-off. All right, so I'm only doing that this week and this week only. It's like your Boxing Day sales, this one. But if you want to send a question in to us, then the number is 0203-239-7543.
Coach at pitchvision.com, of course. We're on the Twitter, PitchVisionAcad. And we hang out at Facebook, facebook.com/PitchVisionAcademy. So you can get in touch with us in any of those ways. Drop your question off to us. And if it's a good one, it'll get on the show. And if it's a really good one, it'll get answered. And if it's a double really good one, it will win a prize. So well done again to Jonty and Lalit. You can subscribe to the show and listen every week, and we highly suggest that you do. It comes out every Friday, and just head over to iTunes to search for Pitch Vision Academy. You'll find us in there, and if you don't want to use iTunes, you can find us by going to pitchvision.com/academy. Click on the podcast link, and the details for subscribing are all in there. That's all for this week. I hope you listen next week, but until then, have a good week. Cheers, Gareth.
Cheers, fellas.